I'm Marlon McGrath from the admissions office, and I get to add my voice, as we have done all weekend, to other voices to welcome you to Harvard, and especially to welcome you to Sanders Theater this afternoon. If you've been around for the past day or two, which I think most of you have who are here now, you will have figured out the obvious, one obvious thing about Visitas, our program, which is this is sort of extended meet and greet program. We are very concerned to be sure that you get to meet each other and that you get to meet my colleagues in admissions, because we're the ones who got to read about you all of that time, and so it's a little bit of a reward for us, we like to think. We also want to be sure that you meet the other people who are at Harvard, the people in the freshman dean's office and the faculty who will be so important to what you do, and the coaches who many of you already know. It's a kind of extended meet and greet program. And you may have noticed, if you really were in the marketing business like us, you may have noticed that it's really not about the facilities and the programs. We have lots of facilities and lots of programs, and you'll get to see them, and you probably have already. But it really is institutions distinguish themselves from each other by who's there. And tomorrow, you'll get to meet and greet up close a lot of faculty members at their open houses, which are listed in the program you have, and we hope you'll take advantage of that. It really is all about the people. This event today is a little different from that. It has people in it. Besides that, though, it for parents and for students and for anybody who happened to walk in here without a ticket, I don't know how secure we are these days, you know, guests on the street, people trying to get out of the rain, whatever. This is an unusual thing, really, at events for us anyway, which is it can give you in a pretty efficient way, if that's all right to use the word, a sense of what on earth goes on here. That is, what is an example of what goes on in universities, what kinds of things when people talk about activities, what happens in universities. This is going to give you a sample. And it's a sample somewhat chosen arbitrarily. A lot of people know about universities that they contribute to human progress and improve the human condition, and there are people who think that they do just the opposite. And there are also, many of you know, that in universities, at their best, they help to change the way we see the world and hear the world. We think we've represented those elements today, at their best, we hope. So in any case, I've got five wonderful colleagues who've agreed to share their Sunday afternoon with all of us on this rainy Sunday. And the first of our colleagues, who's going to come up just in a second, is Gary King, who is the Albert Weatherhead University Professor at Harvard University. That's one of 24 university professors, a very fancy faculty position. He works an awful lot with undergraduate students. In fact, I was just remembering that my own freshman daughter, who had no business bothering him, turned up in his office and, you know, ended up getting very important information and sort of coaching for various things she did later. He's a member of the government department, and his work applies empirical methods to lots of various areas in social science research, and you'll hear about some of that today. Gary.
Hi, everybody. congratulations on the victory tour you're all taking. Right? We should acknowledge your parents, who we've set up these video cameras so that they could watch every move that you're making. You don't mind, right? That's right. Say hi to your mom and dad. anyway, we'll just ignore them, and when classes start, we will turn off the cameras, okay? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about reverse engineering Chinese censorship, but I thought we'd start by talking about how we came to study Chinese censorship, and for that matter, who's we? So we is four undergraduates, two graduate students, and myself, a research team that tries to find out new cool things about the world. And there's a lot of these research teams around campus, and I hope you'll join one, because the coolest thing that you could possibly do, at least from my perspective, is to be there and have a seat at the table when some new discovery is made. It's one of the kinds of things that changed my life, and I think it'll change yours. So I'm going to give you an example of one thing that actually happened. So first thing is Chinese censorship. The seven of us didn't know anything about Chinese censorship, didn't know anything about China. I've never taught a course on China. I've never even taken a course on China. We had no intention of studying this. What were we studying? We were working on methods of automated text analysis. So what the heck is that? Think about social media. So in social media, every 2 days there's a billion social media posts. That's the largest increase in the expressive capacity of the human race in history. It's pretty amazing, right? Any one of you can post something on social media, and at least it's possible for several billion people to read it. However, it is impossible for any one of you to understand what everybody else is saying. Primarily, that's because of your inadequacies. That is you. That is your human, right? You can't read billions of social media posts. To do that, we need to develop something which we call automated text analysis. Lots of people have been working on this. We've been developing these methods to try to understand what billions of social media posts and lots of other kinds of unstructured tech, people saying things, basically, have to say. So we've been working on this. And we developed these methods, and we developed them in English. And we thought, well, let's stress test the methods. Let's push them until they break so that we learn how to improve them. And we thought, well, how could we stress test the methods? Why don't we try them in Chinese, right? We'll try them on Chinese. The Chinese language works completely differently than the English language, of course, right? Like each character can be a whole word instead of just a letter and things like that. Also, these are some Chinese language social media sites. In America, there's Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Snapchat. You can keep going, and you'll probably end before you get to the end of your second hand. In China, there's thousands of social media sites. So the language is different. Social media works completely different. It's a totally different test, so we thought we'd do it. So we developed some engineering technology to go and download social media posts from China. So we started downloading. Imagine a computer that's going and scraping all the social media posts from China. And we tried our methods, and the methods worked pretty well. But there were some things that didn't work well, and our team worked to improve the methods, and we kept going. Then at some point I said to my students, there were a couple of them that knew Chinese, I said, you know, why don't you go back to the website from which some of these posts which we took came, and just try to understand the context. Make sure that we're not scraping the ads rather than the text. Make sure we understand what it's about, you know? So they went back. And we were all meeting, and they said, you know, Gary, we think there's something wrong with the way that we designed the system to scrape the social media posts, because sometimes when we click on the URL that goes with the post, it goes back to the website, and other times when we click on the URL, it sort of doesn't go anywhere. And other times we click on the URL, and a website comes up, and it says something about being investigated. And we looked at each other when we realized, wait a second. We have a technology to download Chinese language social media posts before the Chinese government can read and censor them, right? So we have now millions of Chinese language posts. You like that? Right? So we have millions of Chinese language censored posts. We have the content of the posts. The Chinese people can't read it because their government doesn't let them. But we can read it. Well, I mean, the rest of the students and myself, of course, we learned Chinese over the weekend, so we could. But we have millions of these things. And so we thought, we have a giant bucket of millions of posts that were not censored and a giant bucket of millions of posts that were censored. Let's reverse engineer what they were after. What are they trying to do? Okay. So let me give you a feel for it. When you click on a page that was censored, the Chinese government is not embarrassed about this. Censorship is not ambiguous. This is an example of a real website. And here's what it says, if I translate it. It says, the page you requested is temporarily down. How about you go look at another page? And if that's not sufficient, in the corner here, you gotta look closely, this is Jing Jing, one of China's cartoon internet police, who, just like those cameras, is watching you very closely. Okay? So, and Jing Jing will appear on all kinds of sites, and they know that you know what they're doing. Okay? All right, let's take a step back. What's Chinese censorship? Chinese censorship, we learned, is the largest selective suppression of human expression in the history of the world. Okay? It's amazing. It is implemented manually, by hand, by individuals reading, within a few hours of posting. You post something in China on social media, the equivalent of Facebook or Twitter or lots of other sites, and maybe 200,000 people who are employed in this organization, one of them will read it, and they will decide whether it should remain on the web. These people work in government and inside the social media firms, right? This is a big operation, okay? A big, big, huge censorship organization. It is obviously designed to suppress information. But one of the things that we discovered is that even though the organization is designed to stop the free flow of information, it actually paradoxically provides an enormous amount of information about the goals and intentions and actions of the Chinese leaders. And they may or may not have intended that, but we actually can see it. The really cool thing is you can't find this information in the media anywhere in the world. You can't find it, I believe, from the United States government. You can't find it from anywhere. It's like a giant elephant tiptoeing around. It leaves huge footprints. And we can see those footprints. Like the seven of us, right? We could just see those footprints. So let me tell you about some of the things we learned. In order to really figure out what was going on, we had to figure out the goals of censorship. Like, what are they after? And once you know the goals, once you know what they're intending to do, then we can make social media actionable. And I'll tell you what that means. So everybody knows the goals of censorship in China. It's to stop criticism of the government, to stop protest and criticism about the state, the leaders, and its policies. So the first thing we did is we took our big pile of censored posts and uncensored posts, and we evaluated this, and we learned, totally wrong. So what everybody thought was the case, it's totally not the case. This is not why the censorship program exists. This is not what the censorship program does. So what the heck does it do? What are they doing? What are they after? What's their goal? Okay, so we take a step back, and we think about their goal. It could be to stop criticism of the state, or it could be to stop collective action. Whoops, I gave it away, okay. Don't tell anybody. So we separated the two. We separated the two as criticism of the state or collective action. And we learned through applying methods of automated text analysis to these data, we learned that it is they're not trying to stop criticism, they are trying to stop collective action. What does that mean? That means on the web, in social media, in China, right now, today, you can find posts that say, the leaders of this town, they're slimes, they're corrupt, they're stealing money, they have money in overseas bank accounts, here's how much. They all have mistresses, here's their names. No problem, that's not going to be censored. But if you also say, and let's go protest, that'll be censored. In fact, if you say, the leaders of this town are really doing a terrific job, you know, they're passing policies that we all love and they're making our lives better, let's go have a rally for them. Censored. Okay? They don't want anybody to control the movement of people except for themselves, except for the government. Because that's power. The Chinese government has nothing to fear from the United States government. It has nothing to fear from anybody except for the Chinese people. So that's what they're worried about. They're worried about anybody who has the ability to move people. Okay. So how can we use, so we discovered that fact. That fact was totally not known before. How can we use that fact? I have to prove that to you, by the way. Don't just accept things that I tell you, okay? But I'll prove that to you. Okay, but given that, if you know the goal, it turns out it makes social media actionable. What does that mean? That means the Chinese leaders can use this, and if they can use it, and we can see what they're doing, we can use it. What do the Chinese leaders do? Well, they use social media to measure criticism. Imagine you're in charge of China, right? You have basically more power than anybody in the world, or at least in China, and you decide, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want if you're in charge? You want to keep a good thing going, right? You want to stay in power. So you appoint 100,000 of your closest friends to run all the towns and cities in China, right? And how do you know if they're doing a good job? Well, social media actually is a pretty good idea, right? What's their job? Their job is to mollify the people, to keep them from protesting, right? And so if there's a lot of complaints in one area, you could just replace one of the leaders, right? So stopping criticism actually would hurt them. So we might as well you can imagine the leaders of China saying, let's let them complain, then we can see. Second thing, of course, is they can use censorship to stop events with collective action potential, any events that could actually create the potential for more collective action. Okay, so that's what the Chinese leaders do. What can we do with it? So we can use the criticism and censorship, it turns out, to predict local officials in trouble and likely to be replaced. We can predict policies that generate dissent. We can predict and have predicted dissidents that are about to be arrested. Like we know before they're going to be arrested, that they're going to be arrested. We've predicted that peace treaties are about to be signed before they're signed. We can predict and have predicted scandals before they emerge. Nobody knew this. This wasn't in the media. This wasn't anywhere. But, you know, our little team, right, our four undergraduates, my two graduate students and myself, in my office, we knew. Okay. Well, we can also see disagreements between the central government and local governments, which is really really interesting if you're trying to understand what's going on in the country. Okay, so in order to prove to you that this is the case, I have to show you some evidence, and we do big data here. So we're going to analyze 11 million social media posts. Of course, the four undergraduates read every single one of them, right? No, there's only so much PC you can give undergraduates to do that kind of thing, so that's not actually the case. Okay, so to do this, the first thing you need to know is that in social media, the main thing that goes on is big bursts of activity, right? Big viral expansions of what people are talking about. So people are talking about some particular subject, and then there's a burst of something goes viral. That's the main thing that goes on in social media. So we track the events that generate the bursts. Right? We track the events that generate the bursts. So first thing we do is we're going to need a classification of these events that generate the bursts. All right, so what classification? Well, the first category, it's going to be collective action potential. Right? It's going to be events that are, let's say, actual protests on the ground where people in social media are saying, let's go there, right? Or it's dissidents that have had the ability to move people in the past, and there's a lot of conversation about them. They'll also censor that. So it's very easy to classify these events as events having collective action potential. That's our first category, and as I've told you now seven times, it will be censored, okay? Now, what I haven't told you is that there's two other categories that will be censored as well, and so I just want to tell you about those two other categories. First one's pornography. Not a big surprise. Every government in the world censors some aspect of pornography. As far as whether it's hard to classify things, you can really tell, okay? you know it when you see it, okay? And of course, we reserved all of these posts for future study. I'm so glad you laughed at that. So that's the second one. I was worried. Okay, there's one more category, and this one is totally weird. Okay. You can criticize anybody, any leader, any business leader, any government leader in China, except for the people that run the censorship program. Because they will censor you. We believe, after talking to a lot of people, that even the leaders of China, it might be the case that even the leaders of China were not aware that this was going on. Okay. I mean, I don't really know, of course. They don't confer with us, but... But if you think of the list of all the inappropriate things going on in the world, right, this is a pretty weird one, don't you think? Anyway, so there's two other categories. News about all kinds of subjects, very controversial, very not controversial. Government policies of all kinds of different types. And just so we remember, collective action potential, events generating the bursts of social media that have collective action potential, that's the big one that will be censored. Pornography will be censored, criticism of the censors will be censored, other news will be okay, and government policies will be okay. Okay, so now I have to show you the evidence. So I'm going to take these five categories, and I'm going to show you a histogram. They told me that you wouldn't understand this. Okay, so there's a histogram. Horizontal axis is the amount of censorship. To the right is more censorship, to the left is less. And then I've colored each one of these in by our five categories. Red, yellow, orange are collective action, criticism of the censors, and pornography. And as you can see, the evidence is unambiguous. They all have very high levels of censorship. And policy about all kinds of policies and all kinds of news have very low levels of censorship. This particular graph has the 11 million posts that I told you about. Okay, so we've done it more. So there's no question that this is the case. Okay, so let me zoom in a little more and try to understand it a little better. Ai Weiwei, do you remember the Winter Olympics? Not the last Olympics, but the Winter Olympics. Remember, it was cold. Okay, so anyway, there was a stadium there that looked like a bird's nest. It was pretty cool. The artist that came up with that his name is Ai Weiwei. After the Olympics, he became a dissident, so he started moving people for protest. He was arrested at some point, an event we predicted, by the way. And let me show you what this graph is. On the horizontal axis is time. This is the first 6 months of 2011. The vertical axis is a count of the number of events, the number of social media posts. This is just a small sample. The gray is the number of social media posts. So you can see, and all of these posts are about Ai Weiwei. All the posts are about Ai Weiwei. So the gray posts is discussion of Ai Weiwei, and it's marching along. And then the red post is the amount that was censored. The red is never above the gray. It can only be up to the gray. So there's very low levels of censorship about Ai Weiwei. And then all of a sudden, he's arrested. There's a spike of activity. It goes viral. Everybody's talking about it. He is somebody who has the ability to move people. And so they follow him right up the hill, and they take it down. So that whole spike of activity, remember, you think of this. You're in China. Your friends are posting things about this incredible event, and you can't see what they're posting. You may run into them, and they say, hey, did you see this post? And you say, what post? Right? It's all taken down. Right? You can say what you want, but you can't say what you want to each other. Okay. Here's another one. Zhencheng is a city in China where they make lychee nuts. If you've ever had Chinese food, they'll give you lychee nuts. Whether you like that or not is your own business. Okay. Horizontal axis, again, is time. Gray is the volume. Red is censorship. You see, the level of censorship having to do with the city in China, of course, would be very low until there were riots, protests. When there were riots, there was a big spike of social media volume, and they followed them right up the hill again and took down most of those posts. So they're looking for those events. Okay, now what about, well, let me give you one more. This is an environmental lottery. Again, first 6 months of 2011, same kind of graph. So an environmental lottery, what's that? It's a big lottery, the proceeds of which they use the money to support the environment. It's a nice policy, right? The people of China love this policy. They had a big rally in support of the leaders who came up with this policy. You see the red? They don't like that at all. Right? They don't care what you think. They only care what you do. Okay? They take that down. Okay, what about other things? Okay, this is the one-child policy. In China, if you were growing up in China, you would not have any brothers and sisters, in all likelihood, because the rule is you have one kid. It's pretty amazing. Can you imagine how controversial this policy is? Okay. As it happened during this six-month period, there were no collective action events, so this was not an event with collection action potential. There were things that went viral during this period, speculation that the policy might be reversed, etc. But it wasn't related to any event on the ground where people were protesting. It was not censored, despite that this is like an incredibly controversial policy. Our power prices in the United States have produced plenty of protest, but not on the ground actual protest. But since in China here, there was no actual event on the ground creating protests, it was not censored. They don't care what you say. They only care what you do. Okay, so some conclusions. For freedom of expression in China, the Chinese people are individually free and collectively in chains. So if you actually get to learn one thing, I want you to remember that. They're individually free, but collectively in chains. So it's surprising. For our research team, conclusions are, we got lots more to look into. We had no intention of studying the subject, but we actually learned some really cool things. And we're looking more into China. We're having a peek into certain other countries that you might be able to guess. And then for you, please join us, okay? Now, come to my office. We can all work together. It'd be really great, okay? But there's these teams all over the place, all over Harvard, discovering the next thing that's going to be discovered, and you should be part of it, and I hope you are, and I hope you have a lot of fun. Thanks very much.
Thank you. That was terrific. We're going to have a number of different kinds of things today. Next up is Emma Dench, who's professor of classics and of history and is a Harvard College professor, which, among other things, notes her dedication and success in teaching. She works in the area of the Roman Empire and Roman life and teaches two courses that just sound terrific to me, but then I'm persuaded already. The World of the Roman Empire and Culture and Belief, 59, which is in the general education curriculum, Athens, Rome, and Us, Questions of Identity. And she is going to speak to us. Her title of her talk is The Best Days of Your Life, The Best Days, that is to say, of Your Roman Life.
hello, we have to do a little bit of interim, I don't know, singing in Latin or something like that, just while my very, very, very low-tech PowerPoint comes up. How are you? You're having a good time? Yeah! Are you going to be the class of 2018? Yes! Absolutely fabulous. Well, did you ever wish that you could travel back in time? Yes! I hope so, okay. To ancient Rome, of course. Yes? Yes! But wait, who are you going to be when you get... That's very, very important. You know, when you're time traveling, you have to sort of choose who you're going to be, don't you? Right? Think about it. Do you want to be really old? No! You have to bear with me. Come on, humor me. Do you want to be really old? No! You don't. You want to be in the prime of life, like the kids from a Latin textbook and their really exciting adventures. Let me show you. I'm Milia Poopam Habet. Just wait. Some of you know, ha ha ha. Imelia has a doll. I know, I can see how excited you are. Marcus in Italia in Villa Habitat. This is really mean, isn't it? Because some of you get it. Marcus lives in Italy in a villa. Wow. I'm not convinced we're seeing the whole story here, so let's find out what childhood was really like for Marcus and Imelia. So close your eyes. Close your eyes. Parents, people in the science center, close your eyes. I'm not going on until you close your eyes. Close your eyes. And here we go. Keep them closed. Keep them closed. Otherwise, you're not going to see my surprise. Now, open them! Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's you in a pigeon chariot. Yay! But, sadly, it's not real. It's just the Roman sense of humor, which is really, really odd. They really like miniature things, and here we've got a miniature circus complete with toddlers. Okay. Your real life as Marcus and Imelia starts with baby yoga, Roman style. Here's your nurse, and this is when the parents' backs are turned, so turn your backs, parents, in the science center. She's a bit of a drinker when your parents aren't looking. And what your nurse does is mold, pummel, and pull at your body parts, all your body parts. She's got to pull all your body parts into shape because children are all floppy and flabby. And that will not do if you're going to be Roman, especially if you're going to grow up and be a Roman man. So she's going to pummel and pull and mold you. Great. And here are your cousins at school in Egypt. And they're writing out their scintillating Greek lessons. And what they're writing is biff, boff, buff. Both. Because children all over the Roman Empire learn by rote. They have to learn to write out meaningless syllables. Aren't you lucky? Aren't you lucky you didn't have to do that? And if you're not quick enough, the teacher is standing by with a big stick to hit you because you learn better if you're hit. We like to do that also at Harvard, but that's... That's what they don't tell you at Visitors Weekend. Your parents are really, they're really marvelous. They're on the ball. They make sure that Emilia doesn't take her studies too seriously because she's just going to put off men if she does that, and that'll never do. And they give Marcus, because I'm very, very high tech with my slides, they give Marcus, he's got a bulla around his neck, and that says, hands off, don't touch, right? Because lots of people want to touch Marcus. Don't touch, okay? Don't touch. What the parents really, really want is for Marcus to grow up to be just like Daddy. And he's going to be just like Daddy's Daddy, and Daddy's Daddy's Daddy, and Daddy's 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 Daddy's. And how he's going to do that is, again, one of my sophisticated slides, he's got to stare, he's got to fixate on the masks of his dead ancestors and really, really hope he can be anything like as good as them. Good old Marcus, hey. So Marcus and Emilia didn't exactly go to your local Montessori child-centered school, did they? No, very good, very good. But they had it about as good as it got in the Roman Empire. They were free, they were citizens, there were people looking out for them. They had time to play with a doll, you know? I mean, it was great. But let's cross onto the other side of the tracks, and you're now going to take the form of a slave child. You're going to be Kissy or Snowy. You're so incredibly cute, we're going to name you like a pet, Kissy and Snowy. Isn't that nice? And you're so, so cute that we're going to have you running around with no clothes on, just like a little Cupid. Or the miniature thing. Very fun, you know, very, very sweet. But oh dear, the awful thing about little children, just like the puppy, is that they grow up, don't they? Oh dear, don't they? Little children grow up. Look at you. You all grew up. Oh, you're not cute anymore. Oh dear. You're all sullen and serious. Never mind, we're going to sell you on because old Felix down at the docks could do with a good pair of hands. We're going to sell you on because you passed your best. Okay. And Felix starts you around 7, hauling loads down to a ship. That'll be a better use for you, won't it? Girls can do this work too. Felix isn't too picky. But the really great thing about girls is once you're about 14, we can make you a wet nurse for other people's babies. That's a really good use for you. We're going to do that. Carrying all those loads, it's going to sort of twist your body and mar it. And if you wet nurse for month after month, year after year, like a milk cow, it's going to ruin your teeth and bones. But, you know, there we go. We'll do it. And when you're like that, the philosopher Marcuses of this world are going to look down on you and wonder huge thoughts like, are slaves slaves by nature or just by circumstance and birth? Ponder that. How do we know all this about Roman childhood? Until quite recently, we based our knowledge on great works of Roman literature and grand works of art, like this wonderful mosaic that you all wanted to ride in, didn't you, which comes from a Roman villa in Sicily. In the last few decades, we've been able to dig much deeper to uncover everyday writing on tablets and papyri to track spindles and whorls. Those are the funny round things at the bottom that tell us where and how girls and women worked in the Roman household, to detect damage to bones and teeth through forensic archaeology. If you study the remote past, like I do, and I hope you do, people like to ask you, what's new in ancient history? Ha, ha, ha. Can I have a sort of sardonic ha, ha, ha? Well, what's new in ancient history? The only answer to that is how long you got, right? Isn't it? Yes. But our ever-expanding knowledge is also qualitatively different. We find so much about life in the Roman Empire that was never mentioned or depicted in great works of art and literature. It was just taken for granted, just assumed. Time travel's great. Societies remote from our own in time and space are fascinating in and of themselves, but there's much more to it than that. The deeper we dig into Roman childhood, the more we turn the spotlight on our own values and assumptions, the things we take for granted, the things we just assume. Like our concept of childhood, so recent. Our childhood's like yesterday to an ancient historian. Childhood, half protection of the vulnerable and half commodity. Very, very different from Roman childhood. Or the fact that our society depends on child labor as much as it abhors it. So, class of 2018, I hope, in order to prosper, in order to gain insights into your own society, in order to learn 1,000 fun facts, and maybe even if you're really, really lucky, drive a pigeon cart, study cultures that are really remote from your own, preferably here in Harvard. And I'm going to sign off in Latin. How could I not? Walete. Walete, goodbye. Can you say it? Walete. Walete. Goodbye.
We did promise you a variety show, and I'm really glad we're delivering so successfully. Thank you. Our next guy up is Thomas Forrest Kelly, Knopfle Professor of Music. He is the closest person I know to a musical polymath. He, as they say, does it all. His own interest is in medieval chant, and I don't think that's exactly the topic of today, although I think it's not, in fact, unrelated. But he's going to speak to us on the riot. It's being spring, on the riot at the Rite of Spring in Paris, 1913.
Thank you, Marlon. Thank you. Hi, everybody. I teach a course called First Nights every fall here in this room, and it's a course for people who are taking what may well be the only course in music they ever take in their lives. So it's my one chance to make the world safe for the kind of music I like. There are plenty of other courses, but what this one is about is what it was like to be at the first performances of 5 famous pieces of classical music. So it's kind of time travel. And at the end of the course, we commission a new piece that's given its first performance right here. So we bring a new piece of art into the world. It's a great privilege, and we're the only people who have ever heard it at that first performance. So one of the pieces we talk about is surely the most famous first performance ever, and it's the first performance of a ballet called The Rite of Spring, music by this guy, Igor Stravinsky, performed in Paris in 1913, so it's almost exactly 100 years old. This Paris that was super high-tech, they have electricity, they have cinemas, they have airplanes, they have giant towers made out of steel. They believe that technology is going to do wonderful things for the human race. They don't know, of course, because who can know, that next year World War I is going to break out and kill a huge proportion of the European population. For now, they think technology is terrific. And in the spring of 1913, as in the last several years, the Russian Ballet Company, directed by Serge Diaghilev, this guy here, comes to give its regular season in Paris. They perform in this super modern, brand new Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, the Theater of the Champs-Élysées, which has these wonderful seats, and it's in this building that the audience, what everybody says is that the audience was screaming so loud that the dancers on the stage couldn't hear this huge orchestra that's playing really loud music right below their own feet. And that the choreographer, Vaslav Nijinsky, was standing backstage. He was in his white tie and tails because he was expecting to come out at the end of the ballet and take a curtain call as choreographer. He was furious. He was standing backstage on a chair, screaming numbers in Russian to the dancers so they could stay together. Stravinsky, the composer, who was sitting over there, got so mad that he went backstage and stood behind Nijinsky and held onto the tails of his tailcoat so that he wouldn't fall forward and roll onto the stage. What a scene. I would love to have been there. If you know, many of you probably have played, many of you know the Rite of Spring. If you don't, you probably actually do know the Rite of Spring if you've ever seen Walt Disney's Fantasia. Remember that? Well, the ballet, there's a mysterious beginning, and then the curtain goes up and the dancing begins. And the dancing, it's the most amazing sound. It's one single chord repeated many, many, many times. This sound. Maybe you know that sound. It's one of those, Stravinsky finds all his music at the piano. It's very cool. It's this. That's nice. And it's this. Great. Put them together. Play it 59 times without changing anything. And here's what it looks and sounds like. Not much to listen to. It's good that there's some choreography. How do we listen to that? Well, you might listen to it in groups. Or you might do other things. Stravinsky really liked that chord.
I like very much this chord. A new chord, you know, an eight notes chord, but the accents were even more new. And the accents were really the foundation of the whole thing.
With more time, I would spend a lot of time saying what a liar Stravinsky is. He spends a whole lot of his time making this piece into Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. The idea was not his, the scenario was not his, the choreography was intimately bound up with the thing, and he spent the rest of his life trying to tease it apart so it could be his, but that's another story. The story of the ballet and the sets and costumes were made by this man, Nikolai Rorik. He sent his two sons to Harvard. He was a painter. This is what he looked like before he got all weird and grew the long white beard and moved off to India and stuff. And he was a painter. And he was thought to be an expert on primitive Slavic culture and a great archaeologist and ethnographer. And the ballet is about primitive Slavic tribe and what the rituals they perform in the spring to make sure that the earth will bear fruit. We could use some of that now. We don't have the original sets, unfortunately, but we have some pastel drawings done by an artist at the back of the theater during the performances. And this is a picture of the first half of the Rite of Spring, which takes place in the daytime, and it's full of rituals and ritual games performed by groups, all group numbers. And there's a picture of the second half of the ballet, which takes place at night, begins with the young women of the tribe dancing in this mystical circle. They select one of their number who gets into the middle and stands trembling like this while they do this wild dance around her. She's the one who's going to have to dance herself to death at the end of the ballet so that the earth will blossom again this year. That's sort of what we know about it. There are a few original costumes that survive from that first production, and they're in museums around the world. And my expert Slavic friends say that they really look to them like authentic Slavic costumes of particular times and places. So that was sort of the look of the set. The dancing was designed by the great male dancer Vaslav Nijinsky. He had recently been made the choreographer of the Russian ballet, and he made a dance, a kind of choreography that I think he did it on purpose, designed, some said it was designed to be ugly. I mean, you know about ballet, right? Ballet is about arms, it's about solo dancing, and it's about what they call turnout. You can always tell a ballet dancer because they walk like this. You know, turnout is, you know, doing this kind of thing. Don't I look? And so, wishing to be primitive and archaic, Nijinsky does the opposite. Everything is in groups, no hands, arms down by your side, head weird, lock your knees, put your toes together, not out, and jump up and down. Don't try this at home. Not good for you. And then make people do things in very weird situations. This is a studio photographs of some of the dancers. So, here's the dance that you saw in the pastel, the dance that the young women dance around the immobile chosen victim. You see? This is how it works. This is also the dinosaur music. Here's how this works. It's actually made up of only three things. And there's something that sounds like this. It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the capital letter A, and it always happens in 5 beat units. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But sometimes that same sound, that same wonderful Stravinsky piano sound, just doesn't do the 5. It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 1, 2, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And that's what the little A's are. So it's either. And then there's B. Letter B is something that starts down low and goes up higher and goes faster and faster and is always underway by the time you hear it. B sounds kind of like. That's what B sounds like. And then there's C, which is just another one of those found sounds. C goes slow. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And that's all you need to know about this dance that you saw in the pastel. You won't have any trouble following along with it. It begins after those 11 unbelievable drum beat chords. See that although you might not like the content, Stravinsky is making a very lucid form. A whole lot of A's, a contrast with a bunch of B's and C's with a little red herring thrown in, which he loves to do, and then a return to the sound of all A. So you might call it composition by Xeroxery. Or you might, I don't know what you might want to do. What must it have been like to go to that theater? This is the facade of the theater, which is brand new in the 1913 season. To go up in that lobby with all your fancy clothes on, it was a very big deal, the Russian ballet, to sit in these great big padded armchairs, to sit in that auditorium and scream while these poor people try to dance on the stage. Well, of this academic year, last fall, the Harvard Radcliffe Orchestra gave a concert of the Rite of Spring right here in Sanders Theater, and they asked me to give a little pre-concert introduction, and I said I will on one condition, that we can try what I've always wanted to know, which is, can you or can you not drown out the Rite of Spring? Well, we tried it. Here's an iPhone version. I can get this thing to play. problem is that I can't get the little play button. Oh, there it is. Okay. Check this out. Whoops, sorry.
A thing I've always wanted to do is to see whether it is possible to drown out the light. And so I invite you to scream, not during the performance, now. I'm going to invite the orchestra to play that section of the glorification of the chosen victim. I suggest that we start screaming during those 11 repeated chords, and we'll see what happens.
Done, but it's hard, and it would be hard to scream that loud through the duration of the whole Rite of Spring, which lasts 25 minutes. So I think there's a lot of exaggeration. If I had been there, I wouldn't have screamed, and if they hadn't screamed, we would have been able to hear as well as see the choreography of that section there. Problem is the little play button. Well, I'm going to have to exit that so you can. I want you to see this thing. It's very cool. That's as much as we look. That's the first part of the thing. Curiously, there are people who still hate the Rite of Spring. They think it's savage, brutal, ugly. Of course, part of it is meant to do that because that's what it's a picture of. The subtitle is Pictures of Pagan Russia. But for me, it's a couple of things. One is one of the great artistic collaborations that ever happened. It's not Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. It's Diaghilev and Nijinsky and Rorik and Stravinsky and all those wonderful dancers in that orchestra who put the art together, and I think it should stay that way. Some people think it's unspeakably ugly. I think, without a doubt, it's the most influential piece of music of the 20th century. And what's interesting is what a huge influence it continues to have in our time in the 20th century, and I guess it's going to be a milestone for a long time to come. Come to First Nights, and I'll try to teach you to love it if you don't already. Thanks.
Well, in our continuing variety show, excellent. To have such variety. And now for a little something different. We have Robert Liu, who's professor of molecular and cellular biology at Harvard. That is different from what you've just heard. And he's also the faculty director of the Derek Bloch Center for Teaching and Learning. Now, I don't know whether you're planning to take up this question that Emma raised about our ways of teaching and punishing students. I mean, I guess it's really your field, not mine, to tell you what to say. But in any case, this is a man who, besides whatever he's going to talk to us this afternoon about, wears many, many, many hats here and has had more to do than one can really shake a stick at to improve teaching and learning, especially in the sciences, but not only. And that's what he's going to speak to us about somewhat, I think, building knowledge and passion through science visualization.
So let me add my voice in welcome to all of you. Because what I'd like to do is spend a little time with you talking about how do we understand anything? How do we understand the world? How do we perceive the connections in between things? How do we understand how things work? And what I would argue is that one of the critical steps in any kind of understanding is not only listening, which Tom has just shared with us, but is also seeing, the ability to visualize things, including those things that we cannot see with the naked eye, is absolutely crucial. So that when you think about what happened when you were a child, one of the first things that you did once your eyes opened was that you saw the face of your mother, of your father, and somehow you knew that all was well with the world. That is, until you got hungry and started bawling. But that said, you began to understand your world as you started to actually see it. And very often, that is what happens in the sciences, that we begin to understand how a biological process works. We begin to understand something about the physical universe from what we can see in a telescope. And for me, I fell in love with cells and with cell biology when I first looked into a microscope and saw them crawling around. It was love at first sight, and I knew that that was something that I wanted to continue with. But for me, I became very engaged with things that you can't see with the naked eye, that you needed a microscope to see. And as I went on, and as I went into graduate school, I became interested in things that even a microscope cannot really pick up very easily. So that in science, what we often do is that we study things, we take physical parameters, physical measurements, and we create a model in our mind's eye of something that we can't see. So this is actually a rendering in tremendous detail. The position of every atom along every turn is in fact known in three-dimensional space, and that is the protein complex that is responsible for the majority of energy that you're utilizing right now. As you fidget, as your mind drifts, all of that depends on ATP, synthesized, the majority of it, by this enzyme. But what has always frustrated me is that when I sat in the first Star Wars and the subsequent five Star Wars, when I saw Jurassic Park, when I saw those films where computer-generated graphics were really bringing us into new worlds, none of that, or almost very little, was coming to science. We were not harnessing the tools of World of Warcraft to actually bring worlds to students and also to ourselves as scientists to understand. So that as a scientist, you need to look at things that look very different from that, and you need to build in your mind's eye what this thing might possibly look like. And so what I've been interested in for over a decade is how do we take our ability to visualize things, wed it with text, with more abstract expressions, and come up with something that really gives you a deep understanding of what's going on, and also something that gives you an emotional engagement with what's going on. So that what one can do is take something like that. We know the position of every atom. When it is synthesizing ATP, we know the movements of this remarkable structure. And so my colleagues and I put together the first moving rendering in motion of what this protein machine actually looks like. So we could bring it to life, and one could actually explore this, spin around it, begin to understand just how the shapes change. How does this machine actually work? We could take that three-dimensional rendering and bring it back to the more traditional kind of image that we usually see, showing all those ribbons and all those spirals, and we could actually reveal for the first time how this thing actually moves in three-dimensional space. So that this gives us an insight which we could then go even further, right? We could zoom in at will, and we could look at the active side of this enzyme, and using a modeling from the world of chemistry, determine the geometry of exactly what happens for that energy currency that we all critically depend on. so that for the first time, we could share with students and with our colleagues, how does this look in space? We could interrogate the model, because lo and behold, we discovered that things we had assumed, when you put them into three-dimensional rendering, you know what? That would get in the way. So you have to do this cyclical process of reassessing what that model actually looks like. But for me, that was not what initially got me excited. The molecular level was exciting, but what I loved were cells, right? And if you look at, for example, a textbook diagram, we're looking at how a white blood cell that trawls around all of your blood vessels discovers that there's some kind of site of infection down here, squeezes its way out, and fights that infection. We could even see it in video. Here we see a live mouse, and what we're visualized are in fact those white blood cells that are rolling around on the walls of blood vessels. The reason why it's moving up and down is because the mouse is breathing. So this is a live video capture. But what does this mean about all, how do you connect the things that happen at the molecular level with something as remarkable as that? And so several years ago, Alain Viel and I were both faculty members in molecular and cellular biology, got together with a team of artists, a group of undergraduates, and created an animation that we felt was sort of a proof of concept. Can we bring cinema to the visualization of scientific processes? And so what we were able to do is to visualize those cells rolling on the walls of your blood vessels. We could begin to see how protein-protein interactions connect cells with the cells that line your blood vessels. We could take a look at the surface of the cell, the various proteins that are present in the surface, and then we could dive inside the cell and start to explore the architecture. What are the architectural, the structural elements like? And how is it that these structural elements can somehow change their arrangements so that unlike the beams overhead that are holding up this roof, in the cell, the architecture is remarkably dynamic. It changes all the time. It assembles and it also disassembles. There are different varieties. Some are very thin, like actin filaments, that can be severed very easily, while others are very large and very rigid, like microtubules. But these are not just elements of architecture. They also lay out the organization of the cell, so that proteins literally drag gigantic sacks of material throughout the cell. It is a universe that is not unlike the universe that you might have come from your town or your city. There's remarkable organization. There are power plants that actually move. Messenger RNAs are extruded out of the nucleus, and those are the templates of information that allow us to determine what proteins are made inside the cell. So that in fact, this is a remarkable universe, and each of these renderings are based on known three-dimensional structures, biochemistry, and biophysics in terms of what actually happens. So when we did this originally, we thought this would be just a little fun thing for us to share with our students here at Harvard, and it went viral. So that over the 5 years, it has been downloaded more than 30 million times. It is considered the most viewed science animation in history. And when last we checked, 70% of your high schools use this animation. So you may have seen it as a visualization for what the cell actually does. But we have continued. We have continued to explore now individual components so that you can dive into that very same power plant that I told you about, and you can begin to understand how the proteins that are in that power plant, the mitochondria, actually get there, and you can explore this universe as well, connecting the activities of different proteins with the generation of energy inside cells, so that now you can put things in context, and for the first time, this is the first time it's ever been visualized, how all of the different components that synthesize ATP actually come together in the context of the mitochondrion based on current research data. Now, it's very beautiful, it's kind of interesting, but this is also a representation. The structures are correct, but this is much simpler than reality. Because, of course, if you were to look at the environment as crowded as it actually is, you wouldn't be able to see anything. Because what you would see is this. This is what it's really like. Vibrating under Brownian motion, densely crowded. And so this is what the environment is of every single cell based on the algorithms we're using to model the vibration of molecules at body temperature. And so now we can sift things together, knit them together in truly remarkable ways. But the question is this all worthwhile? There is no question that text remains an absolutely crucial way for us to access, for us to engage knowledge. Language will always be that primary mode of engagement. The question is, can we combine text with a moving image to change how you grasp, how you learn things? So for a number of years, we have done large-scale studies looking at whether or not there's a difference between using text and using text combined with animation. We have done this across a variety of topics in the sciences, and I'll just share with you sort of a couple of examples for you to retain a simple concept. Groups of students using text alone versus text combined with supporting animation. Against a maximum score for simple retention, that is what you get from two topics averaged across more than 150 students. But when you combine text with animation, there is a statistically significant gain in terms of retention. Retention 3 months after you have actually interacted with the material. But here at Harvard, simple retention is just the beginning. Your learning is primarily focused on synthesis, on application, and ultimately on creativity. So once again, what happens with those two topics? With the text alone, 3 months later, not doing so well. But when you combine it with context, with animation, a significant gain in terms of synthesis and the ability to apply concepts in new and novel settings. But that is not what learning is all about exclusively. What we've also realized, you need to care. Right? It's not enough that you remember something. It's not enough that you can apply it. We want to go further. You need to have that emotional engagement, that motivation to learn more. You are all in this room because Harvard saw in you that capacity for leadership, that capacity for passion. So the question is, do you want to learn more? With text only? Once again, 3 months later, maybe not so much, but with the broader context, a significant gain in sustained interest. And of course, you know what cramming's all about. What happens over time? Nationally, it is a well-documented fact. So when you do your victory tour across schools, it's no different. That after 12 months to 2 years, the decline in learning is incredibly steep. What is striking? Harvard students actually start out in the initial phase more than double the national average. Nationally, immediately after a course ends, that this has been measured most clearly in physics, the national average is around 20%. So Harvard students start off well, but like everyone else, declines. What happens after 2 years with a combination of a combined learning experience? A much slower decay in learning. So what we hope is that here at Harvard, in all of the fields, you will have an opportunity to use your eyes, your ears, all of your senses to take in a truly synthetic view a multi-angle perspective on what the world is about. From that eye, we will do everything we can for you to take it to the mind. And ultimately, what we all saw in you is that opportunity for creation, for leadership, for making a difference that we know you will go from eye to mind to inspiration. That is our aspiration for you, and we genuinely hope you will come. Thank you.
Multimedia is a theme of the day. So I have the pleasure to introduce, as our last speaker, one of our own. David Malin, I mean that in lots of ways. David Malin is a senior lecturer in computer science for the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. All of his degrees are from Harvard, including that first one, his AM in computer science. He teaches a lot. He teaches a lot here, like he teaches the biggest course taught here, which is a story, but we won't tell that today, or maybe he will, CS50, the introductory computer science course. But he also teaches, you don't say the masses, but he teaches online in open courseware and has reached hundreds of thousands of people with his instruction. So he's technical and he's many other things. He's a homegrown prodigy, both in technical areas and as a master marketer. And he is, as far as I'm concerned, a Pied Piper, whom we're delighted to have as our wrap-up batter, actually. And the title of his talk, I gather, is Hello, World.
My name is David Malin, and it was 15 years ago that I was actually a freshman here. And I remember all too well arriving on campus. I'd just gotten out of FOP, the freshman outdoor program, where you spend a week hiking and kayaking and the like with some of your classmates. And I got back to my dorm, which was Matthews Hall, room 201, if you happen to visit that dorm yet. And then I proceeded for several months to be one of these incredibly uptight Harvard students who, in one of his first meetings, I remember, with his proctor, which is like a resident advisor that you have as a freshman inside of your own dorm, I think I probably planned out all 4 years of my life in the first week of college. And what this meant was all 32 courses that I was going to take, I had decided on that first week or so. And though she was quite kind not to reprimand me at the time, and I sat down in this meeting with my proctor, and she helped guide me through the course catalog. And honestly, this is one of the biggest mistakes I think I made when I first got here to campus. I started off on this path of concentrating in government, which was probably the most familiar field to me, not so much because my high school had government per se, but because I kind of liked history, I really liked constitutional law, and I was kind of in this mindset of unknowing what that world might be. And I figured in the context of all the other classes I'd taken, English and Spanish and history and the like, you know, governments felt like the best fit. And so I put my head down those first few weeks. I signed up for gov classes, for economics, for math classes, all of which would satisfy prerequisites, and by my sophomore year, I was probably halfway done or more with the gov concentration. And it wasn't until my sophomore fall that I actually thought and got up the nerve to step foot in the classroom of a certain class known as CS50, Introduction to Computer Science. And I hadn't even gotten up the nerve to do this my freshman year. I was sort of too intimidated and kind of too turned off by what I assumed computer science was. I remember all too well my friends in high school were behind this closed door in the computer lab and were typing away at something fairly mundane, it seemed. And it just wasn't at all exciting to me, this idea of just programming a computer to do something. I really didn't know it, I didn't understand it, and I really had very little interest in it, even though I was pretty comfortable with a computer, I liked computer games, and I kind of knew my way around, but it hadn't really sparked my interest. And indeed, I assumed that most every kid in CS50 my freshman year would know far, far more than I, and had been programming since they were 6 or 12 years old or the like. So it just didn't seem like a world for me. And only sophomore year did I finally get up the nerve to step foot in the classroom during what's called shopping period, and even then I only stepped foot on the condition that the professor at the time would sign the pink slip that would allow me to take the course pass-fail, thereby sort of lowering everyone's expectations for me. Now, fast forward to the end of the semester, and I actually changed from Gov to CS that same year, and I signed the form that changed me over to the other concentration. It was because for the first time, academically, like, school had become fun. And no joke, and it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but I would look forward on Friday nights, living as an upperclassman in Mather House, to the piece sets or the problem sets release so that I could spend my Friday evenings working on CS50's programming assignments. And it was the first time, truly, that I enjoyed what I was doing. I think in high school, I was all too wrapped up in this tendency to sort of put my head down, focus on doing what I thought I should be doing and excelling at whatever I was given, rather than excelling at or thriving in something that I genuinely loved. And this isn't to say this is going to be the same for you, Shirley. Surely there's some other field that might be of interest, but I can say in retrospect that some of the best classes I ever took were these classes that were well beyond my own comfort zone, computer science being the biggest, but even anthropology, 1010, Introduction to Archaeology, Professor Tom Kelly's First Nights, which I also took, and Dramatic Arts 101. And shamefully, I took so many of those classes late in life, my senior year. But even then, these courses can have an impact. So we got an opportunity recently to sit down with a young woman by the name of Susan Wojcinski, who is the CEO of YouTube. And she too was an underclassman here years ago, and she too wasn't computer science initially, and it wasn't until her senior year that she found this class, which was CS50, and she'd like to say hello.
Hello world, I'm Susan Wojcinski. I'm the CEO of YouTube, and I took CS50 when I was a senior at Harvard in 1990. I was actually a history and literature major, and my junior summer, I realized that maybe I wanted to learn something about computers. And so I came back, I took CS50. It was hard, but it was the most amazing class I took. It changed how I think about everything. And when I graduated from Harvard in 1990, I went to Silicon Valley, and I got a job, and I've been working in tech ever since.
It was actually Susan's garage that Larry and Sergey of Google fame actually started Google some years after her graduation. So what does this mean? What is computer science? Most of us, myself included, back in the day, conflated it with programming, but it's really not. Programming is a tool, to be sure, that we use to solve problems. But CS itself is really about solving problems more generally. And computational thinking, which is sort of the buzzword around the field, it reduces to thinking more carefully, more methodically, and taking as input some amount of data, some problem, and then producing some output, which is hopefully an efficiently gathered, correct solution to that problem. And even though probably some 73% of you have no prior computer science or programming experience, at least based on your predecessors, odds are most everyone here knows how to look someone up in a phone book, even though this admittedly is a bit of a dated technology. And if I wanted to look for someone like Mike Smith in this phone book, I could certainly start at the beginning and then turn to page 2 and then turn to page 3 and then turn to page 4, each time looking for Mike in the phone book, and eventually I would find Mike Smith if he's in the phone book. But no one in this room is going to look for someone like that. Odds are you're going to at least optimize the solution and do maybe 2 pages, and then 4 pages, and then 6 pages, and then 8 pages, thereby doubling the speed with which we can find Mike. But even then, most of you are not going to do that either. What are you going to do? You'll go roughly to the middle, right? And in the middle, I find myself in the M's, and so Mike Smith, last name S, has got to be to the right. And what's interesting there is that we already all, as humans, have this intuition to tear the problem in half, right, and sort of maybe not so dramatically throw half of it away over there, but we're now left with a phone book that doesn't have some 1,000 pages, but maybe 500 pages. And now I can again use that same algorithm or process and look for Mike Smith, and oh, no, I'm not quite far enough. I hit the T's, so I can tear the problem in half again, throw it away, and now I have 250 pages, then 125, and so on and so forth, until finally I have, hopefully, just one lone page of Mike Smith on which I can finally find his phone number. Now, who cares? Why is this interesting? Well, that first approach I took, I could kind of plot in this way. So x-axis is the size of the problem, the number of pages or number of people, and then the y-axis is how much time it took to find Mike Smith. And so we can plot with this red line a linear relationship. If there's one more page, with my stupid, naive, but correct approach early on, I can find Mike Smith with one additional unit of time per page in the phone book. And then I can optimize that, and I can do the twosies approach and go 2, 4, 6, 8, and the slope of that line feels better. It takes less time with the same number of pages, but I wager that we can actually do as well as this. This green line is sort of the wonderful optimum, because even as the size of the problem, the number of pages gets huge, I have barely more time to spend to find Mike Smith, right? If I took a 1,000-page phone book, doubled it to 2,000 pages, no big deal. It's one extra tear. If that phone book sort of unrealistically had 4 billion pages in it, 32 page tears is all it would take to reduce 4 billion pages to just one. And this speaks to, then, what computer science can do and sort of the ideas with which you're probably already familiar but would find in far greater quantity and interest in the field. But to apply these ideas, we typically need a tool. And programming is that tool. And what, then, is programming? Well, let's take a look at this clip from our friends at code.org.
I was 13 when I first got access to a computer.
My parents bought me a Macintosh in 1984 when I was 8 years old.
I was in sixth grade.
I learned to code in college.
Freshman year, first semester, intro to computer science.
I wrote a program to play tic-tac-toe.
I think it was pretty humble beginnings. I think the first program I wrote asked things like, what's your favorite color? Or how old are you?
I first learned how to make a green circle and a red square appear on the screen.
The first time I actually had something come up and say, hello world, and I made a computer do that, it was just astonishing.
Learning how to program didn't start off as wanting to learn all of computer science or trying to master this discipline or anything like that. It just started off because I wanted to do this one simple thing. I wanted to make something that was fun for myself and my sisters. And I wrote this little program, and then basically just add a little bit to it. And then when I needed to learn something new, I looked it up, either in a book or on the internet, and then added a little bit to it.
It's really not unlike kind of playing an instrument or something, or you know, or playing a sport.
He goes on to make the shot. So we don't have nearly enough time to actually learn how to program, but we can give you a quick taste of it. If one of you would be brave enough to come up on stage in front of all of your future classmates, this was the first hand I saw. What's your name? Lauren's gonna come on up. You have to be comfortable on camera and ergo on the internet. Come on up. So to give you a taste of this, why don't we write a couple of super short programs that are not gonna overwhelm with complexity, but at least give us a sense of just how easily we can do this. So very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Come on up to my keyboard here, and I'm gonna go ahead and load a super simple program called Nano, which is sort of immaterial. It's like Microsoft Word, but sort of black and green and purely text-based, no mouse support. And go ahead and just write print, or rather, let's do echo, E-C-H-O. And now, whatever you would like to say to your classmates, like hello, comma, world. All right, now let me go ahead and hit a somewhat cryptic sequence and hit control here, save this. And now go ahead and type good, the name of the program you just created.
Good.
Enter. Nice. So, well, Lauren has written her very first program. Let's do one other example in a file called better. This time, don't say echo, say the word say, S-A-Y, and then something else you'd like to say to your classmates. Excellent. Excellent. All right, now let me go ahead and save this and go ahead and type better, which is your second program now.
Hello, class of 2018.
Oh.
Very nice. And how about for our best example, why don't you go ahead and do what just comes to mind and start typing away, and then we'll run the program you've written. Go ahead and just type as fast as you can, anything.
Okay.
Go ahead. Nice. Okay. No, keep going. You're good. You're good. I like what you're doing. Nice. Keep going. Nice. And, oh good, commenting your code as well. Excellent.
Okay.
Let me go over here now and go ahead and type best, Lauren's third and final program.
Best.
Excellent. So even with, even with some fairly cryptic syntax, to be sure, can someone who's not really or never programmed before?
No, not really.
Not really makes a great story, so we'll go with that. Not really programmed before can compel a computer to do things like this. And notice, this is just the Mac or maybe the PC that you guys have on your own desk. Now, again, we don't have much more time to share with you how you might go about doing this, so I can only invite you to join us this fall. So if you would, Lauren and I would like to conclude with an invitation by way of video to this class I myself took and Susan took some years ago, so that you will hopefully join me and Lauren this fall. I give you 2 minutes of a video made by two former students of CS50. Of you have no prior experience with computer science.
This is the CS50 Hackathon, an epic all-nighter during which CS50's students gather above the Harvard Innovation Lab and HBS's Hives, working throughout the night on their final project. Just a few hours ago, we had pizza. Several hundred were quickly devoured. Coming up soon at 1 a.m. will be Chinese food, and at 5 a.m., hi-hat. This is the CS50 Fair. Hello, Internet. Thanks so much for tuning in to this epic display of CS50 students' final projects here in Northwest Science, one of the larger buildings on campus. And as you can see here behind me, we have hundreds of students and hundreds of attendees enjoying popcorn and candy and snacks, as well as, most importantly, hundreds of final projects.
So that's it. I wish that weren't so. Thank you, all five of you, for an absolutely spectacular afternoon. For those of us with attention deficit disorder, this kind of multimedia thing for a class period, a long class period, would be really, really, really nice to mount as a regular piece of the curriculum. And then we can all go dig deeper as we wish. But in any case, thank you for coming today, all of you. Let me say, before you walk out the door, several things. One is that for anybody who's here who's a parent, you were invited, more than welcome, to go to Science Center B, where there's an event called Parents Welcome. I think you've been welcomed already, but you can be welcomed again in Science Center B. You will have two deans of Harvard College, present and future, and other senior administrators to talk about whatever is on your mind and what is on their mind. Well, you can see what that is. And at the same time, 4 o'clock, nominally in the schedule, there is a big, up at Hillis Library, you can be shown the way, a big extracurricular activities fair, which we hope students will want to go to. I bet you will. Have a good time. And then, if you wish, and this I hope you will do too, at 9 o'clock tonight, we reconvene right here in Sanders Theater for the Visitas Palazzo. So there's also lots of other things along the way to do. So look at your schedules. But we hope to see you here tonight, and thank you so much for joining us today.